Welcome, guys, to Behind the Shield. My name is James Gearing, and this is episode 24. And my guest this week is someone who kind of hits a little closer to home. Dr. Joseph Ibrahim is the Trauma Medical Director, ORMC, Orlando Regional Medical Center, which was my primary hospital in my old fire department and is my primary trauma center even now. Now, we are going to talk about the Pulse shooting. That is not the whole focus of this interview. Dr. Ibrahim is an extremely interesting and intelligent man, and we draw all kinds of things from his brain. But touching on the Pulse incident for a moment, my old station, my old first U, we could hit Pulse with a rock. It was just within the city of Orlando's limits, but we were the next station over. And then the shooter's secondary target that he was trying to decide if he was going to hit that instead was now my first U, Disney Springs, in the Disney area. So that incident hit home. Now, I was overseas. I was actually in Portugal with family when it happened. So I was really, you know, torn up to see both these areas that I love affected that way. So back to Dr. Ibrahim. He was one of the trauma team in that incident. And we certainly want to talk about that. That's an incident that a lot of people want to hear about. And there were some great lessons of things that went really, really well and some things that they changed after through the first responders perspective and through the ER perspective. But I also really started delving into his mind about trauma in general. I mean, outside of that, we get the shootings, we get the stabbings, we get, you know, the car accidents, all kinds of trauma. So we talk about intubation in the field, tourniquets, needle decompression, all these things that we're taught and how often they use. Are they effective? Would they be better used more, you know, by the first responder out in the field, maybe even looking towards changing some of our protocols to be a little bit more aggressive in some of these areas. And another thing that I wanted to put in the intro was at the end, Dr. Ibrahim recommended a movie, a documentary called Newtown. And he said, have some tissues ready. And I'm a bit of a kind of cry like a three-year-old girl if something really plucks on the old heartstrings. And when the Sandy Hook shooting happened, which is what this movie was about, I had a son in kindergarten. So it tore me up then, and it really tore me up to see it. It doesn't focus on the tragedy so much as the parents and the kids' lives before the event and then how they were affected after. And that really kind of, not that I need reminding that much, but even that shook me up again about how important it is for us to train in all areas, but obviously trauma is a huge one. We all have schools in our first U, whether you're a volunteer fire department or you're in, you know, Manhattan. We all have multiple schools and daycares. And sadly, I mean, it terrifies me to think about this, but this could happen in any of our elementary, middle, high school, colleges. So being on top of our game, you know, with tourniquets, with our trauma medical knowledge, it's so, so important, because you could be sitting down with your crew having dinner and the next thing be in the middle of your worst call you could ever imagine. So we touched on that. We touched on setting the bar high and keeping your training high and involving your local ER staff to help train with the first responders, you know, getting that chain of survival as tight as possible. So I absolutely love this interview. You could probably tell I've been prepping online. I think this is an area that we don't delve into enough. Where we as paramedics or EMTs can set the ER nurses and doctors up for success by what we do pre-hospital. So it was amazing to hear Dr. Ibrahim talk. I'm pretty sure we're probably going to talk to him again in the future, because I had a million other questions when the interview was done. Just to preface this, we did have a little technical difficulties on my end. My computer basically had a stroke, and so then I overcorrected some of the settings. So the first 9 minutes sound a little rough. They're still fine, but they don't sound as clear as the previous podcast. After about 9 minutes, though, everything settles down. I found where the error was. And then the rest of the podcast should be crystal clear, as I hope that most of ours are. So that being said, phenomenal interview. I beg you guys again to go on iTunes, take 60 seconds. Give us a good rating. The higher our rating, the more visible we are online through searches for people that haven't heard about the podcast. And if you haven't told everyone you know, please do. Find a favorite episode, share it, say you have to listen to this, whether it's sleep deprivation or PTSD or mental toughness, whatever it is, and let's try and spread this knowledge of these amazing people that we have. So without further ado, I introduce to you Dr. Joseph Ibrahim. Enjoy. All right, so welcome Dr. Joseph Ibrahim. Firstly, very first question, am I saying your last name correctly?
Yes, sir, that's perfect.
Okay, fantastic. All right, so you are a trauma medical director, RMC, and I'm obviously going to go into the trauma side and some of the events that we've had in Orlando recently. But can you start by telling us about your upbringing? You were born in Tennessee, is that correct?
Correct. I was born in Nashville, but grew up in the mountains in East Tennessee.
Okay. And tell me about your childhood unit. What was your family like?
So my father was a general surgeon in a very small town. My mother was a nurse anesthetist, had two sisters, again, very, very small town, you know, single traffic light town growing up. You know, father and mother divorced at fairly young age when I was around 12, but I was always around medicine. Was fortunate enough in high school to have opportunities to shadow people in medical environments, even to the point got to go to the operating room as a senior in high school and really get some up-close experience since my mother worked in the OR. And you know, was always around medicine from that point on. Did research in undergraduate where, you know, got to do animal research, you know, operating on hearts, doing cutting edge stuff with satellite cells and things like that, where it was just myself and Dr. Gao, who was a research genius doing cutting edge things way before satellite cell implantation became well known. And just a very great environment for me, very fortunate all the way up. And then got to work in medical or in college. I worked in medical records in the hospital, then worked as an EKG tech, and got to work in various environments that made it just kept me around the hospital all the time. So just very, very fortunate all the way around when it comes to that.
Okay. And just educate me for a moment. Satellite cell, what exactly is that?
So those are the cells that are not differentiated. So they're at the basement membrane of our muscles before they develop into skeletal cells. So they've not differentiated yet. So what we would do is take those and basically cause a heart attack in these animals and then inject these cells before they differentiate, with the theory that the environment that they're in, being surrounded by other cardiac muscle, they would differentiate into cardiac muscle and actually contract. And to the point that he actually did some patient trials in China and things like that, and it was really cutting edge for a 20-year-old to be able to be on the front lines of doing those kind of things.
Absolutely. And is that the same kind of philosophy as stem cell?
Yeah, same thing. Okay. Satellite cell, stem cell, same thing.
Okay.
Sorry.
Mm-hmm. No, you're fine. Yeah, I've researched a lot of that, more on the musculoskeletal injury side. I just had a meniscus repair a while ago, and I'm intrigued to see if it progresses to the point where it might even regenerate the meniscus. I'd certainly get that done if that was the case.
Sure.
But all right. So just touching back with your parents, and the reason I want to touch on this is I myself am first generation immigrant from the UK, and your parents were not born in the US as well. Is that correct?
My father was born in Cairo.
Okay.
And yeah, he was first generation. I'm first generation from his side. My mother was from the States. She grew up in a very, very rural area in Western Kentucky, you know, so much so that they didn't have running water till 1985. Everything was from a well. So yeah, so two different sides of life for sure.
Yeah. And how did an Egyptian meet a young lady in Kentucky?
They were, she was in nursing or anesthesia school in Nashville where he was doing his general surgery residency.
Okay. So doctor nurse relationship.
Correct. Yeah.
All right. Brilliant. All right, so you were exposed to medicine. What made you choose trauma specifically?
Well, you know, initially starting out, I was torn between family medicine and surgery. I know that sounds like two different ends of the spectrum, but I wanted to be able to take care of whatever came through the door. You know, whether it be heart attack, whether it be an aortic rupture, whatever, whether it be a gunshot wound. And, you know, as I went through my training, you know, it became more and more apparent that surgery would be the better avenue to take for that. And then through my surgical training, you know, I liked basically all facets of that. I loved all of my surgical training. When I came down to Orlando to do my critical care, I actually did that more so thinking I wanted to be able to follow my patients and take care of them wherever they were in the hospital, whether it be a regular floor, whether it be the ICU, whatever. So I really initially did the ICU training, the critical care, more so to be able to keep with my general surgical patients, really not thinking I would just be as involved with trauma as I have become. But when I came and did my fellowship, I just became enthralled with it. I loved every aspect of it. You know, taking care of the total patient, you know, getting being able to operate on anything from the head and neck all the way down to, you know, leg injuries and obviously the chest and the abdomen. So, you know, one of the last few true general surgeons, because everything's become so specialized these days. I really do believe the trauma surgeons and pediatric surgeons are the last surgeons that can really take care of whatever comes through the door.
Yeah, no, I'm guilty of kind of holding some areas of medicine's feet to the coals with respect to chronic medicine and trying to kind of lean people back towards looking at their nutrition and their exercise levels as opposed to turning initially to long-term chronic meds. But trauma obviously is one of those areas of medicine that you cannot fix with, you know, with herbs and potions. There's a certain point where if you snap your femur in half, you're obviously going to need to see a trauma surgeon. So I think it's definitely one of the purest areas of medicine still as well.
Oh, I agree. But to your point, doing those things up front, taking care of your body, taking care of your health, and doing all those proper things do have a significant impact. If you are in a traumatic situation or traumatically injured, they do significantly impact your outcome, I believe.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Yeah, I agree. We had CrossFit, I think he was quite a champion, but a high-level athlete and also a firefighter, Matt Chan, on the show a few weeks ago, and very, very muscular, very, very fit. And he had a mountain biking accident where the front part of his saddle went in and ruptured, not the actual femoral artery, but one of the initial branches that comes right off it. And his surgeons told him exactly that. It was still compartmentalized. I don't think it broke the skin, so it kept everything in place. But had he not been as in shape as he was, he absolutely would have bled to death.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
So, that's amazing. Very interesting. All right, well, speaking of that, so you yourself obviously appear to be in good shape. So what do you do for sports and exercise?
I do a lot of just running and swimming. I've actually started swimming more and more just as I get older because it's easier on the joints. Used to do taekwondo fair amount with my family. We took 5 years of that. Did jiu-jitsu for 3 or 4 years. Really enjoyed that, but figured some of these younger guys doing jiu-jitsu didn't care if I had my shoulder in place or not. So,
oh, really?
I better get out of that and do something that's could conserve my career. But swimming and running and a little bit of weights and just, you know, watching your diet, I think all those things come into play. It's just, I think it's a good balance to do all those things.
Right.
You need to do. You know, getting rest is something that none of us do, right? I mean, in medicine, I mean, EMS guys, fire guys, we're no better. Rest is probably the one area of our lives that we don't do very well.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the big pushes that I have on this show. And actually is something I'm going to be pushing for within the fire service is for some reason, the standard week has been 56-hour weeks of which these men and women are up, you know, as you know, the areas around ORMC, they're not exactly quiet areas. So they're getting their asses kicked, you know, for 24 hours and then wondering why they're sleep deprived, wonder why we're seeing some of these mental issues manifesting. And I think the sleep is a huge part of that.
Absolutely.
Okay. So you touched on what brought you to Orlando. So can you elaborate on that?
Sure. So yeah, I came back here for my fellowship in 2006 to 2007. And then I did my fellowship a little differently. I took it after my third year of general surgery training. Again, had a wonderful experience here, loved it here, but I still had commitments back in East Tennessee. So went back to East Tennessee and finished my last 2 years of general surgery. They asked that I stay on staff there, which I did for a couple of years at a level 1 trauma center as an assistant professor with East Tennessee State University. Enjoyed it very much, but again, wanted to build what I had seen here. Obviously, you can only build it to a certain extent. You know, I can't bring the volume when it comes to trauma. You know, trauma has its own volume. So, you know, in a sense, I kind of got bored, so to speak. And fortunately, Dr. Michael Cheatham, who's my chairman, my boss, but he's also a mentor in every part of my life, to be honest with you, he would call me pretty regularly, you know, once or twice a year. Hey, are you interested in coming back? We'd love to have you back. And, you know, I kept kind of putting it off. And in 2011, I was just at a point in my career up there that I just kind of really didn't enjoy getting up and going to work, which was unusual for me. And so my family at that time agreed to come down and check things out. And we did. And financially, it didn't really make sense, but it's where we felt led. And it has been just a great experience and opportunity that I'm so blessed that we took advantage of.
Yeah, it's certainly a good city to go to if you want to see trauma. I worked at Rescue 70 just down the road, so Orange and Oak Ridge, and yeah, I mean, we brought you all kinds of, you know, horrendous cases. So all right, so touching on that, something I want to educate myself and my fellow EMTs and medics out there. So can you first tell me what makes ORMC a level one trauma center? And then specifically after that, why and when we call a trauma alert, you know, what kind of ball is rolling after that point? Because obviously I know we have criteria and we initiate it, but it'd be good to hear from your side, you know, what happens and you know, why that impacts the patient.
Sure. So a level one center has to have certain capabilities and people ready and available 24/7. So we have an in-house trauma surgeon. We all stay here, you know, 4 or 5 nights a month. We're in actually sleeping in the hospital or trying to sleep. Rarely do we sleep. But in addition, we have neurosurgical capabilities, orthopedic, interventional radiology, which is so key to a lot of the things we do. All those on the ready and, you know, available within 30 minutes. We also have ORs available, you know, at any moment. So that's proven itself over and over again to be so crucial. In addition, people always ask, especially recently in Florida, level one versus level two. So level one and level twos are in theory supposed to be able to provide the same level of care. The difference is a little bit on the timing, as I just kind of alluded to. But then the other thing that sets a level one apart from a level two is the research component. So let me talk a little bit about that. So what you guys, you know, don't really see a lot of is the research side that all nine of the trauma surgeons are involved with. And what that means is, you know, we're doing constant quality assessment of what's going on with our patient outcomes. And in addition, what that allows us to do is do cutting edge techniques. For instance, we were just talking in here about my kind of pet, the Reboa catheter you may have heard about, the resuscitative endovascular balloon that we actually insert in the trauma bay. And actually, the Department of Defense is looking at using this in the field with military. But it's basically, it's a catheter with a balloon on the end that we can insert through the femoral artery and occlude the aorta, as opposed to doing the old-fashioned opening the chest, you know, finding the aorta, putting a clamp on it, and then rushing up to the OR. We put this catheter in, and within 4 to 5 minutes, we occlude the aorta, and the patient stabilizes almost immediately. It's just been amazing. And with that comes our ability to be involved in multi-center trials. We're currently involved with the American Association for the Surgery of Trauma national trial with multiple centers. And we're the third biggest user in the country with that, along with Baltimore and Houston. So that, I think, sets us apart as a level one from a level two. And then the other part is a level one is that you're responsible for doing community outreach. What that involves is you need to take what's your biggest admission issue, which for here in Central Florida, our trauma center and most trauma centers across the country, it's ground level falls, which I know you guys get called on all the time.
Yes.
So, you know, whether it be a nursing home, whether it be a house, you know, had a lady fall down her stairs the other night, you know, and we're finally realizing that that's not something to take lightly, that people can have significant injuries from that. So what we do here, our trauma program manager, Susan Ona, who is outstanding, But she's done some outreach to some of our senior centers and things like that to tell them about little things like wearing the proper shoes, to eliminating transitions in doorways as those that are commonplace for people to fall, and things like that. And then we're also involved with the initiative of Best Foot Forward, you may have heard of. It's an initiative and a program here in Florida to make people aware about one of our biggest problems, or one of the things we're number one in the country for, and that's auto versus pedestrian. And, you know, people commonly think, well, it's Orlando, it's the tourists and things like that. Well, the research would show otherwise. It's actually our own people that are getting hit by. Oh, yeah. It's actually not the largest percentage are people from the Central Florida area, not tourists. So, you know, they've done things, you know, making sure people try to identify the crosswalks, to making sure you're paying attention to the walking signs and things like that. So we're also heavily involved with that as well. So that, you know, some, those are some things that set us apart from a level two center that you won't see with them.
Okay. Yeah, just touching on that, one thing I observe coming from England is, you know, being able to turn on make a right turn on the red. If people don't stop in the crosswalks, you think of something like OBT, which is what, 8 lanes, I think, across.
Right.
You know, there you got big vans, SUVs, whatever it is, and they're blocking the vision. It terrifies me because these people are flying through these reds to make a right, and all it takes is someone pushing a stroller, you know, and then the next thing you've got, you know, a dead kid. So I think educating the drivers is a huge part of trying to reduce those injuries too.
Oh, absolutely. That's another key part of that initiative. It's not just the pedestrian paying attention, but you're absolutely right. It's the drivers looking for the crosswalk, because it's so easy, as you pointed out, on those turns like that people don't even look. They just, oh, no cars are coming, I'm turning. And you're right, somebody's in the crosswalk, and there they are. It doesn't matter that they're in the crosswalk or not, the car doesn't see them.
Yeah. Now, I want to touch on what you said about the balloon for the aorta. Is that for trauma anywhere in the body, or specifically an aortic rupture?
It's anywhere in the body. So basically, well, I should say anywhere below the diaphragm. If it's above the diaphragm, then we really probably shouldn't use it. But it's something that's used initially in the trauma bay. The biggest benefit, I think, has been in the area of pelvis fractures, which, again, we see a lot of, especially with our auto versus pedestrian community, but also with motorcycle crashes and things like that. People have open book pelvis fractures, have significant bleeding. As we know, historically, that's a very difficult and treacherous area to try and control bleeding. And in most cases, we end up going to interventional radiology for embolization of those. And this has just really kind of bridged that gap between, you know, putting a binder on and they're still hypotensive, to getting them to the radiology suite so they can get embolized. Because historically, that time period between putting the binder and sitting in the trauma bay and getting to interventional radiology, you're constantly giving blood products and things like that. And obviously, still the patient is at risk because they have ongoing hemorrhage. But this has significantly impacted that. And we've seen great benefits here just in the 20-some cases we've had.
Wow. And you said, thinking about the military using it, is this something you foresee first responders using one day as well?
I do. Actually, you know, UK has used it some, as have Australia first responders. But their setup, which you know is a little different. And in Australia, they actually have physicians on the flights with them. But their flight teams are actually using it in a few cases that have been reported.
Right. Yeah, I think that's one of the most frustrating things about being a medic, is you hit that educational ceiling. And I'd love to see us, you know, create yet another level that we can progress to, we can educate to provide an even higher level of care before we get to the hospital.
Right. And I think, you know, this catheter, they really keep streamlining it and changing it so that it's really extremely user-friendly, and making it more and more of a have a safer profile to be used in that kind of setting.
Right. Brilliant. Now, touching on trauma out in the field for a moment as well. Backboarding has always been an absolute, you know, bane to a lot of first responders. We see that obviously it doesn't seem to immobilize very well. I'm told that there's no research even supporting its use. Many, many fire departments are getting away from it now. As a trauma surgeon, obviously you see this and you see the cervical and spinal damage. What's your view on backboarding and should it go away ultimately?
Right. Well, yeah, first of all, I just want to say thanks to all the first responders. You know, I have to tell you one quick story if you have just a second. So my experience with first responders. I, when I was a resident, I was driving one Sunday afternoon and came upon a two-vehicle crash, and I was the first one there. So two people unresponsive, and a cop was there, and I told him who I was, a surgical resident. We get out, and two people were basically in respiratory arrest. And anyway, he didn't know what to do, and I try to get in the car. I finally get in one of the doors. They're all kind of smashed in, and get in one side. I'm trying to hold their airway, you know, hold their neck up, to your point. So trying to get some air any way I can into these people. And I was trying to figure out how could I get them out of the car. It was just me. And, you know, just thinking about our first responders and how just they're quick they are. It's just amazing to me. And so I remember this very large paramedic walking up, and I said, I got two people unresponsive, blah, blah, blah. And I said, I can't get the door open. In stride, without even thinking, reaches, finds us, we're in East Tennessee, finds a big rock by the side of the road and smashes the window in the back, and we get the people out, I mean, in just within seconds. And I was like, man, that was brilliant. How did I not think of something like that? But anyway, my hat's off to them, because they're just amazing at how quick thinking they are and doing the things they do. I'm spoiled that we get to do all the things in a nice setting. You know, the patient's on a bed, they've got great lighting. You guys are on the ground in the dark. So I my hat's off. But back to your question about the boards. You know, I think you're right. I think things will change over time. Right now, I think I still have to speak. The standard would be to keep them on the board. And I think it's just more honestly to protect us. If something were to happen, did you do the standard? And I think that's still the standard. Will that, and I agree with you. I mean, we see people all the time. In fact, I was in the ER the other night. The person was on a longboard laying on their side, all curled up. So in one of the rooms, I was like, well, that's probably not doing much good right now, other than creating potential bed sores or, you know, pressure wounds in that area. So I think long term, we're going to come up with something different for that. What that's going to be, I wish I knew. But I don't, right now, I would still have to advocate for using boards this time, just because we don't have any way to say for sure what is the best right now.
Yeah.
And I think that's the most accepted. If something were to happen to somebody, did you do the standard? And I think that's kind of what the standard is as of right now. But do I think that's going to change? I do.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like I said, when you realize there's no real research behind it, and you see these people slipping around all over these boards, I think our medical directors now have allowed us to be more intelligent with the way we kind of analyze the injuries, and then allow us to put the patient in more of a position of comfort, especially some of these elderly people with the terrible spinal curves that you lay them on a board and they're in agony. So
sure. Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the issues come into play when you have people with distracting injuries, right? They have a terrible femur fracture. They have terrible, you know, other injuries, and they can't really tell you, yeah, my back hurts. Maybe it's a little more subtle. And then you miss something subtle, or they end up having something that was potentially dangerous. That, you know, that's always a tough call. So that those are the areas that I think we just have to get some more information on.
Right. Understood. Okay. So I guess we'll move forward now to a very, very poignant event in our city's history. So June 12th of last year, correct me if I'm wrong, this is kind of per the research I've done online, you got a phone call middle of the night, is that correct?
Yes, it was around 2 a.m.
Okay, so tell me about that day, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure. I was on call, had been on call the night before, and the Friday night, and that night wasn't, you know, it was, relatively busy, as you know what that's like down here. We had the shooting at the a local concert area where the young lady from The Voice got shot by a stalker, and so we thought that was going to be our biggest thing that weekend. But so 2 a.m. I was in bed. Obviously, I'm on backup call. Chad Smith was on call. And around 2:15, he calls me and says, hey, there's a shooting in a club, and they think we're going to have 20 victims or so. I'm going to need you to come in. Like, I'll be right there. So I jumped up and threw on my scrubs, and I live really close. So I was in within 10, 15 minutes. And so, you know, when I walked in, we still didn't have the significant police presence We weren't on lockdown yet. It seemed like a typical quiet outside night to me from the side I came in, you know, all the way until I got to the trauma bay. And once I opened the double doors on the far end of the trauma bay, and it was obviously something I'd never encountered before. And we had patients in every bay, patients perpendicular to the typical situation. A lot of people just kind of running around. It was just full. Patients kind of screaming and yelling, and it just was obvious that this was a much different situation we'd ever experienced.
Yeah.
And so, I looked up and I saw Dr. Smith at the far end of the trauma bay. So I said, well, I'll start on the near end and kind of meet him in the middle. We'll just start triaging. And first one I came to, the gentleman had a very large wound to his chest and abdomen, and looked to be fatal, and started to evaluate him. And Dr. Smith came up to me and he said, no, Joey, I've already triaged him. There's nothing we can do. I told him just to give him morphine. And so that's something, maybe in the military setting you might have some experience with, but in the civilian setting, is again, your experience with, we don't do that, right? We do everything for every patient. So I just kind of had this blank stare at him for a second and then realized he was exactly right. This was a true triage situation. And so then, going to the next one, and just remember assessing different patients, sending the next one up for surgery, sending our fourth year resident up with him to get things started. And then it wasn't very long after that Dr. Cheatham came into the trauma bay, and Chad had called him also. And I informed him that we had sent one up to the OR. Could he go cover that case? And then I would bring the next one up. So I took, after assessing three or four patients, I then took one of them upstairs and did my first exploratory laparotomy. And, it's just a different mindset, that you quickly have to go into. I remember I had a third year resident with me, and we took care of the abdominal wounds, and we didn't close really any abdomens that night because, again, damage control, you take care of whatever's bleeding and or leaking or whatever, and you put a temporary dressing on, something we call a wound vac, and we get them out of the OR. And we didn't close anybody, short of one surgeon closed one abdomen that night. It was a pediatric surgeon. But that's kind of the damage control mentality. You get whatever is life-threatening taken care of, and then you move on to the next one. And I remember he had several wounds going down his left arm, and the resident looked at me and said, do we need to do an arteriogram and evaluate his arm? I said, no, we're going to wrap it with a betadine soaked gauze, and if it bleeds, we'll put a tourniquet, but he's probably going to lose that arm. But we've got to move on. That's not going to kill him. And she looked up at me the same way I looked at Chad, like, what are you talking about? And then she quickly realized, same just like I did, you're exactly right. We've got 20, 30 more patients down there that need us. So that, again, is something that's very, very different from our training that now we actually do incorporate into our training, but nothing that the typical civilian training incorporates. So I finished that case, went down and found, saw several more, and helped some of the residents get patients to the ICU and things like that, and then took my next patient up to the OR for the next X-lap and took care of that patient. Again, didn't close them. I think on my third one taken up, we got a page saying code silver, which meant that there was concern that a gunman was in the ER. So I was up in the OR area at this time and turned the corner, and there were two heavily armed police officers outside the OR I was going into. So, you have two feelings. You're like, all right, I'm safe. But then at the same time, you're thinking, my whole team is still down there in the trauma bay.
Right.
What's going on down there? And again, the same resident was with me, and I just told her, look, let's just take care of this patient. We'll figure it out. So we took care of that patient, and everything was on lockdown at that point, meaning we were basically stuck in the OR area. So I began going room to room to see, if somebody needed an extra hand. and went in one room where Dr. Havron was working with Dr. Patel, our vascular surgeon. The patient had a very bad subclavian artery injury, and knew they were going to be busy for a while. But they said they were good. So went to the next room, and there was one of our other fourth year residents, Dr. Bada. He was prepping out the leg, and he said, "Hey, the vascular surgeon is going to come help me explore this femoral artery wound." I said, "Well, no, he's got his hands full. Two doors down, I'll just start scrubbing. I'll help you with this. We can do this." So I scrubbed in with him. We took care of that patient. And, again, going back to that, the trauma training, you might, even though I'm not a vascular surgeon, we are very well trained in taking care of vascular injuries. So that's again, one of the reasons I went into this, but, it was just patient after patient. And then once we finished that case, the code silver had been lifted. They figured out that they were just hearing the gunfire from three blocks down, because, as you know, the pulse is very close to our facility.
Extremely close.
Yeah, so when they breached the wall or whatever and they had to shoot out, the shooting sounded like it was in our ambulance bay. At that point, they were, we were not on lockdown anymore. Went back down and helped evaluate some more. I think I did one more exploratory laparotomy after that, and then began, seeing some of the lesser injured patients. And all that went on and on till around 7:30, at which time, is a testament to our facility. I mean, everybody involved, environmental services, we had orthopedics guys helping us take off tourniquets and evaluate people. I mean, it was our critical care medicine guys were running the ICUs and recovery room, and it was just, again, a total team effort. But, at that point, we had one pulse victim still in the trauma bay, which is pretty amazing. We've now, gotten everybody into beds and things like that. And so at that point, the day teams were kind of responding that maybe didn't hear the mass call in the night. And which that was a blessing too, if everybody would have shown up at once, we all would have been dog tired. So as it was, we had some fresh eyes and brains and legs coming in, which was good.
Yeah.
So we, I remember we sat down in the trauma bay and laid out all the patient lists, because we had around 60 patients that were in the hospital already on the trauma teams. So we kind of divvied up, okay, who's going to round on what? And then we also needed to go back through all of the pulse victims and make sure all their injuries, because we took care of the most life-threatening injuries, but there may have been some lesser injuries that we missed. So we needed to go back through and reevaluate what we call our tertiary evaluation. So we did that. Just another resident, one of the senior level residents, and I went and made sure we saw every single patient. And after doing that, we all met back up and, just kind of continued. I started meeting with our hospital incident command. Dr. Cheatham and I would alternate, which that's a system that was put in place to have all the department heads be able to talk to each other directly to determine what things you need. Like, for instance, for us, we were in great need of chest tubes and wound vacs, as I mentioned. That hospital incident command allowed me to look directly at the supply guy sitting next to me and say, "Hey, I need this and this and this." And he made one phone call and we were fully stocked, and just amazing. And our hospital, again, the environment's amazing in that they do that pretty regularly. If we're full for other reasons, or if we're just, the ER's backed up, things like that. Our chief operating officer has gotten into a habit of calling incident command just for everybody to come together and make solutions. And so when we had to do that on that evening, it wasn't something totally new, right? Again, that's, I think, key to the success of that. But, it was something, that went on, to be honest with you, that was a very long day. I was actually on call that Sunday and took care of an incarcerated hernia, appendectomy, and I helped with an ovarian abscess over at Winnie Palmer. So, the main thing that we wanted to get out was that while we had this tragic event occur and we had to deal with a lot of the patients from that and victims from that, we were back open to the rest of our community within a few hours. And again, a testament to the system.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say from the outside looking in, I was actually in Portugal, and there's a strange irony to the whole thing. My station, like I said, was right down the road. I mean, you could hit Pulse with a rock from the edge of my first U in Orange County. And then when I moved to Reedy Creek, Omar Mateen, the shooter, I guess he had two targets. Pulse was one and Disney Springs were the other. And that's where I protect now. So it was a kind of weird twist that I wasn't physically able to be there, but potentially it could have been, you know, me on that scene as well. But I was so impressed with that. I mean, just the overall scene. I mean, I'm sure it wasn't perfect in every single element with, you know, the first responders and some miscommunication, but overall the event itself, the way they killed him, you know, when he came out, you know, guns blazing like in the movies versus most SWAT incidents that are pretty stable, all the way through to you guys and how you dealt with this incredible influx of patients. From the outside looking in, it looked absolutely amazing. You know, the whole scene went the way it did.
Right. No, it's, you know, it went better than any drill we've done. You know, you always do your drills and, you know, you're your own best or worst critic. And I remember, you know, thinking, oh, we can do this better, that better. We finished this event and we had our debriefings and such, and we were like, yeah, I mean, obviously there were a few things here and there like you're mentioning, but overall, yeah, from EMS and police all the way through, we couldn't have been more satisfied with it, honestly.
Yeah. Now one thing I was going to ask you as well, so did you absorb every single patient? There weren't any sent to Shands or any of the area level one trauma centers?
No, so we got all the critical ones. 11, I believe, did go to Florida Hospital. And while it's not a trauma center, I think they were pretty minimally wounded, so they felt like they could go to the closest center and get care.
Right.
Some showed up a couple days later at some of our smaller centers like Dr. Phillips and things like that with minor wounds as well. But all the major injuries were brought directly here.
Okay. All right. So I guess the next question is, I mean, it sounds like everything went phenomenally well, but I mean, one of the whole points of the show and this interview is for us to learn, us to grow. So firstly, you guys specifically in as trauma surgeons and in the ER, what were some of the lessons you learned from that particular incident? And what, if anything, what did you change after that?
Sure. So some of the things that we've encompassed into our training and our for mass casualty training is that, and we've actually incorporated into our regular traumas now, if somebody needs to go to the operating room truly emergently, you know, like right that second, then we can actually go up to the OR, you know, and they will open the OR around us, as opposed to calling and saying, hey, call us when you have the room ready. We get the patient to the room and then the room gets ready around us.
Right.
And that way we bring ER staff with us until, you know, we make that transition or that pass off to the anesthesia team and the OR team. And that just cuts down on some of the time needed. And in a mass casualty situation, that gives you more bed availability in your trauma bay. So, you know, that was something that night, you know, I remember calling up and telling our front desk person, hey, we need to come up. And they said, okay, give us 10, 15 minutes. I said, no, you don't understand. We're coming right now. You can open the room around us. And, you know, it took some talking, you know, and making them understand, hey, we need to make more beds available. We've got to do this. And they're like, okay. I mean, it didn't take very much talking, but we found that was much more beneficial. And then the other thing, when we went on lockdown, as I mentioned, some of the surgeons that were called in, additional surgeons that were called in, they could not get to the trauma bay. So instead they had to go directly to the operating room and we would shuttle patients up to them. And as a result, we found that is a little more efficient in a mass casualty situation. So now, and that's very much like what the military training and exercises do. They have people that are in the ORs waiting and they have people that are triaging and they send them their way once they evaluate them and figure out their injuries. And that, especially when you have a close unit like ours, I mean, there are 9 of us and we work together very well. We've known each other, at least 7 of us have known each other for about 10 years or more. So we know each other very well, trust each other to take care of patients and evaluate patients. And you know, if they send somebody up to me in the OR saying they've got these injuries of X, Y, and Z and need surgery, then I can do the surgery. And that model has shown to be beneficial in multiple mass casualty situations and military training. And that's something that we've adopted. Now, for our mass casualty training as well. And then, you know, lastly, as far as lessons learned with, you know, our pre-hospital care, you know, we already do drills with them on a monthly basis. We rotate through different services, whether we go to Lakeland, Apopka, obviously Orange County, and we do drills with them. And I think communication, is, as you probably have seen and heard and experienced, that is 99% of the battle. And, you know, that evening, I remember some of the paramedics coming in and asking me, hey, I can't get back to the scene. What can I do? And I said, well, you're better at IVs than me. Put IVs in these folks. And just having that open dialogue and that ability to communicate with each other, what are the needs and where can I help? And so as a result, you know, we just, with our EMS, we've had that for a while now, but with our like OPD, the Orlando Police and the Orange County Sheriff's, incorporating them into the drilling even more and having their evaluations, because the police department actually brought in 11 patients that evening. So I think they were the second biggest transporter that night. So in a mass casualty situation, that's what you're going to see. You're going to see your police departments really stepping up and contributing to patient delivery. And I think that's important to recognize and important to involve them in the training and the drills that you do.
Yeah. Yeah, one of my previous guests, John Spira, he was one of the first guys on the Aurora shooting in Colorado. And he said the same thing. I mean, they were initially trying to do the structured triage, but then it kind of went to the point where patients were getting thrown in whatever they could and transported in police cruisers and I think even private vehicles.
Yes.
So yeah. I want to touch on that a little bit, because he mentioned in his how we have the start triage, and obviously we need a framework. You mentioned that there were some weaknesses and some areas that in real life didn't pan out the way that they would in training. The patients in the pulse, were they triaged using start triage, or was it more just brought in, you know, as a constant flow?
Yeah, very much like you're saying. Initially, I think they tried to triage, but then as the number increased, I mean, we had a window there where we had, I want to say, 38 patients in 42 minutes.
Wow.
So, yeah, to do the typical triage with the tags and things like that, it's kind of unrealistic at that point. So, yeah, it kind of just becomes get them here and just evaluate them, you know, once they get here. And we did have a system where our critical care medicine and ER personnel were evaluating patients when they first were brought to the emergency department in the kind of the bay there with ultrasound and vitals. And if they were hemodynamically stable and had no free fluid in their abdomen, they could do a little more structured evaluation versus if they had either unstable vital signs or had fluid in the abdomen, they were brought directly to the trauma bay for us to evaluate.
Right. Okay. So I want to talk about more about pre-hospital. So I know one area that is kind of introduced, but I know I've only been a fireman for 13 years, but when I first became a fireman, tourniquets were almost like, you know, these terrifying pieces of equipment that if you put it on for more than 60 seconds, the person's leg was going to drop off.
right.
So obviously that mentality has changed now. So obviously from Pulse, but even from the other pre-hospital traumas that you have, are you seeing now in the civilian arena a good result when these crews are using tourniquets?
Yes. I mean, I still don't see it as much as we would anticipate. We have started with the Stop the Bleed campaign that you're probably familiar with to educate not just obviously pre-hospital personnel, but, you know, the true what can be considered maybe even more of a first responder or a pre-first responder, and that's civilians that are at the scenes, on how to put on tourniquets, how to hold pressure and things like that, and, you know, educate people that, you know, the research does show that nobody's lost a limb from a tourniquet if it's only left on for 2 hours or less. And it's funny, in doing some of these classes that we've started, you know, talking with civilians, you know, I remember this one gentleman telling me, oh, I thought anybody that had a tourniquet on lost that limb.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, that's not exactly true. And in fact, you know, most of them don't, the majority don't. And even further, the fact, at least if they do lose the limb, but it saves their life, we still have a live person. And, you know, people just are so fearful of, oh gosh, are they going to lose their limb? And when you truly have somebody that's exsanguinating, I mean, that's a life-saving situation. And I think, you know, I have not seen a significant increase in our pre-hospital personnel usage of that. We did see a few that night, as I mentioned. I had some people helping me take those down. And you know, a lot of people feel uncomfortable because it does hurt. As you probably know, when people have tourniquets put on properly, if they're conscious, it's not comfortable at all. But it's not intended to be, because it's intended to stop the bleeding. So, you know, it's difficult to crank that down on somebody with them wide awake. You know, and you just have to instruct them that this is stopping you from bleeding to death, and hopefully they'll understand later. But yeah, I think that message needs to be taken out there, as you're talking about. It needs to be told to people and make sure they understand that those can be a life-saving, not just in a mass casualty situation or a shooting. You know, we talk about people falling off ladders, you know, tree cutters. They got sharp instruments in one hand, they fall off a ladder, and next thing you know, you've got a significant limb injury. You know, motorcycle crashes we see all the time with significant limb injuries. So I think having, you know, whether it be EMS, pre-hospital personnel, or even a civilian put on a tourniquet, I think that's crucial. And as we've alluded to, I think it's life-saving.
Right. Okay. And then touching on another kind of, not gray area, but maybe a misunderstanding, the airway. So obviously, you start medic school, it's all about intubating, and then we have the King tubes, and then people say, non-rebreather, back valve mask is good as well. But the goal for me is to be the best medic I can be and prepare the patient to in the best way for you guys. To think about, you know, the large bore IVs or, you know, whatever it is that's going to set you guys up for success when we walk through your door. So in an ideal world, not catering to the lowest common denominator, which a lot of the medical direction I know is kind of aimed at, a good intubation, is that still the ultimate thing that you're looking for a medic to bring through the doors?
I mean, obviously it makes our life easier. I think in the properly trained individual, it is a life-saving event. Have I seen adverse events from attempted intubation, or, you know, intubation that they thought was proper or that got dislodged somehow and now is in the esophagus? Yes. And I told you, I've been blessed or cursed with however you want to look at it, with a few experiences of being in the field, being the first person on a scene, and even helping EMS, you know, try to intubate, things like that. And again, my hat's off. I'm blessed with lighting and instruments and all those things. I don't know how you guys get proper intubation ever. It's just amazing to me. But, you know, A good intubation is, you know, very beneficial. Do I think you can oxygenate somebody sufficiently with bag valve mask? I think so. You know, and I just have seen enough where I think it depends on your comfort level and your level of training. You know, we see some horrific injuries here. I saw horrific injuries in Tennessee where, you know, the airway is very difficult. So making an attempt is probably better, just to get a mask on them, start bagging them, and get them to the closest facility to get them intubated properly. You know, I know that's a difficult situation, and that's something that's easy for me to sit here and say in the trauma bay, seeing things that roll in, as opposed to being the guy in the field having to make that call. But I do think that's something that we're going to have to continue to look at. The good news is they keep coming up with more and more instruments that make it easier, you know, things like the King tube that we seem to use a lot and see here. Different scopes now where you actually have a camera view on your laryngoscope.
Right.
And I think those type instruments are going to make it more and more facile and more just better for our EMS providers to be able to do that in the field. But, you know, with the traditional laryngoscope and doing it in the field, I think if you are not very well trained, which goes to our responsibilities too as trauma centers, what are we doing to help you guys do some airway courses? You know, we all have these simulators now where we can make difficult airways. We can do different things. How do we incorporate you guys into that education? We do it for our ER residents. We do it for our surgical critical care people. Should we not be partnering with you guys and doing that? I think the answer is yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And getting you guys more engaged with that. And that way you have that same comfort level as us. Because again, you guys are having to make the same calls we are, but you make it in the dark on a roadside, whereas I get to make it with a patient in a bed and 5 to 6 people around me helping. So I think that's where we need to look at, is how do we get you guys more training and more comfortable with that when it does happen in the middle of the night with a, you know, guy hitting a motor, running his motorcycle into a wall or a sign, and he's got a bloody airway and he just has to be tubed. How do we create that level of comfort so there's no anxiety and you just do it just like you've done 100 other times on a mannequin, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think not defending, not making excuses, but a challenge that a lot of first responders have, especially if they are a firefighter and medic, is that we're just jack of all trades, master of none. So it takes so much training to make sure that you're competent, because you might be intubating, you know, a three-year-old, and then your next call be having to rig a rope system to rescue a guy off a, you know, a window cleaner. So our scope of practice is so huge. It takes a lot of training, which this is what this whole thing is about, is not making excuses, but reminding ourselves, and myself included, that if we get complacent and we stop training, it's not being dramatic. Lives truly do handle, you know, hang in the balance. Because if we miss these tubes, you know, consistently, I mean, that might be the difference between someone living and dying.
Yes.
So, okay. Staying on that kind of intervention, another area that I hear people talk about is needle decompression. When you have, we have certain parameters that we're supposed to have before we decompress. Is that another area that you see could be done more aggressively as well in the field?
Yeah, that's funny because, you know, I was a few months ago, I was down in the trauma bay and they brought somebody in, and I remember they're giving me the story and I'm looking at him like, this guy didn't meet. And he's like, well, I really wanted a needle decompressive, but he didn't quite meet our criteria. I was like, well, we need to help you guys out on that. You need to be. And then I go and look at the criteria, and then I reviewed a couple more cases where, you know, maybe it was different units or things like that, but they had needle decompression and maybe wasn't quite indicated. So again, to your last point about all the things that you guys have to do, you know, it's just, again, it's amazing and can be overwhelming, I'm sure, to do all that training. But I do think we need to give you guys, and there have been multiple papers talking about EMS and paramedic discretion to determine, you know, trauma alerts and things like that, even if they don't meet criteria, and how that sometimes is better than using the criteria that we use.
Yeah.
So I think giving you guys a little more freedom and a little more autonomy, in addition to, again, giving you the training, giving you that practice, is so key. Because, I mean, I've seen guys, I mean, seen it used just beautifully, and it was a life-saving situation. And I've seen it sometimes, and the catheter didn't quite get into the thorax. You know, I do my CT scan and it's sitting in the pec muscle.
Right.
Or, you know, it's it was put in and there's no pneumo, but there's a pneumo on the other side. And so, again, I have the benefit of getting to play Monday morning quarterback by looking at it through the CT scanner, not being in the field trying to listen to the breath sounds in the back of an ambulance or in a helicopter or things like that. So, again, I think it's just more experience and more training. But I do think based on, and that's, again, this is backed up by more and more research, that the more training we give pre-hospital personnel, the better decisions they're able to make. And quite frankly, they do a better job at assessing what the patient needs than even our criteria can determine.
Yeah.
So I think that in the long run, that is something that probably would be beneficial.
Okay. And another area I'm trying not to delve in too deeply, so I'm not breaking any HIPAA laws, but my last day at Orange County, let's just say that the gods weren't happy. The third of my patients that I brought, my partner and I brought in, was a gentleman that had basically come out of a house fire on fire. By this point, third degree burns from head to toe. The only thing that wasn't burnt were the soles of his feet. But so our only option really, apart from, you know, airway and IO, was a burn sheet. So is there anything on the horizon as far as pre-hospital care for care for burns, or is that always still going to be the kind of only thing that we're able to do, apart from controlling the airway and fluids and pain? Yeah. Pain medication, of course.
Honestly, I don't know of anything new on the horizon for them pre-hospital. There's lots of stuff, you know, in the hospital for their wounds and for things like that. But pre-hospital, there's not much that I'm aware, unfortunately, because there's just so much that you need to assess, you know, to do too much in the field and too much there. you know, like we just had one the other day. I had to do an escharotomy on once he got here for his circumferential burn of his leg, so he didn't lose pulses in the leg. You know, they're just little things, not little things, that's a big thing, but things like that, that in the pre-hospital setting, it's going to be very difficult to determine. And even obviously to be able to do something like that in the field would be very difficult at the most. So I think for burn stuff, we're still kind of behind, unfortunately, on the pre-hospital side, and that there's just not a lot that we're able to offer them until we really get things evaluated. And to be honest, there are things that we see, you know, we'll think they're a certain percentage, and then we get them debrided and cleaned up and everything, and turns out they're a much higher percentage than what we once thought.
Right.
And they need more, you know, and that increases or maybe pushes them over to requiring a resuscitation that involves the Parkland formula. Whereas prior to their debridement, we thought, oh, they don't need Parkland formula, they just need fluids at 125. And then we do the Parkland formula, or we do the debridement, and it's like, oh my goodness, I underestimated by 10%, 15%, 20% what their needs were, what their burns were, and now they need significant more amount of fluid. And so I think that all those things are so limiting in the field, because you can't really clean them off. You're trying to rush things to get them here. Your main things are still your airway and pain control, and you know, giving at least some fluids before they get here.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So another area I kind of want to kind of steer us into now. I'm going to read a few names first before we delve into this, because obviously Pulse is just, you know, one day at ORMC, and I've brought so many shooting victims and stabbing victims. I know a lot of my peers have, especially from the, you know, OBT Pine Hills area where there's a lot of violent crime. But you guys also, and I believe these people were all brought to you, Lieutenant Deborah Clayton, Deputy Norm Lewis, Deputy Brandon Coates, Deputy Jonathan Pine. So we had, you know, several of our law enforcement officers slain the last few years. You yourself, you know, did you notice any effects mentally after, you know, the Pulse specifically, but also just the collective nature of being a trauma surgeon? And then also, did you see the effect on your peers in the ER as well?
Well, I think, you know, the Pulse in general obviously brought our whole community together in a much stronger way. And I think, you know, the events you're discussing, obviously I can't say too much about each one, but as far as the impact everything's had on all of us in general, there's no doubt that there's a lot more solidarity between us and our, you know, our friends and colleagues, brothers and sisters in the police, in the Orange County Sheriff's Departments, and in the, obviously, the EMS departments around the Central Florida area. So there is no doubt that when one is injured or harmed, that it has a significant impact on all of us. And that was, you know, been very well demonstrated on that day and on several other days, unfortunately. But, you know, there's no doubt that we're all much closer in our training, but also in our losses when things like that happen. So, again, I think Pulse is partly responsible for that, probably a major responsibility of that, or a result of that. But I think those events, you know, now have much more meaning than what they did probably prior to Pulse. And again, it goes to the point that we do a lot of training we do together, a lot of different drills we do together. So we know each other on a regular basis. And as you pointed out, ORMC is a busy place. You know, Friday, Saturday night, you know, I was at Chipotle the other day, and I see two officers come in, and I went over and just introduced myself and thanked them for what they do. And they're like, oh, I thought I recognized you from the trauma bay. And so, you know, we all kind of know each other now and recognize each other and try to say hi to each other, not just at these events and these drills and these things like that, but when we're out and about in our community. And I think that speaks to the collegiality and speaks to the unified manner in which we seek to serve our community.
Yeah, I agree. You hear these separations of jurisdictions, or police versus fire, or medics and nurses not getting on. And you know, we take a step back. We're all part of that same chain of survival, whether it's, you know, on the police side or the EMS side. And for there to be any separation doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
No, I agree totally. I agree. And like I said, I mean, I think, unfortunately, you know, we had that tragic event, but the main, one of the big things was the unified manner, the whole city really came together, and that our EMS and police and our, obviously our trauma center really kind of combined. And then, you add on top of that, we're doing things like stop the bleed. You know, what do we do positive going forward from that? You know, we enhance our drilling, we do things like that. But then we also go out to the community and how do we get educate them on stopping the bleed and being aware and all these different things to do to make our area safer.
Yeah, absolutely. It was interesting. I had Sebastian Junger, who wrote Tribe and Restepo and some of the other work that he's done. And Tribe is basically about how fundamentally humans are tribal and how in times of tragedy, whether it was 9/11 or the bombings in World War II in London, how they saw mental health was so much better. There's a huge improvement as people banded together and felt part of something again. I think that's lost in society and in a lot of ways, especially in this electronic generation that we have. And sadly, it takes tragedies like these sometimes to bring people back together.
Absolutely. That goes to, you know, you talk about, I think that's another reason I like trauma is because it's definitely more of a team or tribe. I like the tribal link there, mentality. And, you know, growing up, I played a lot of sports and things like that. So very much team sports minded, and trauma kind of leans itself in that direction. And obviously with working with EMS, working with police, and you see that across the country. You know, I talk to other trauma directors and they're involved with their SWAT team and they're involved with different areas and different teams and different parts of their community. And, you know, obviously there's a big part of us that wants to serve, but there's a big part of that also that is serving us and serving something that we need inside of us. And I think you've hit it on the head with the tribal aspect of it, that need for support and being able to support others at the same time. You know, and the one thing I talked to a group called Volunteer Florida, just a great group of individuals who were here in Florida just to, it was from all across the South, actually. They're all in volunteer communities. Very few are medically trained, but they want to help see how they can help their communities better. Just an amazing group of people. And so I got to talk with them. And, you know, we talked about, it's just, you know, when you break it down, it's just humans being human, right? I mean, doing the right thing. It shouldn't be that difficult.
No.
And sometimes it is, as you pointed out. But if you could just break it down, it's really not that hard, I don't think. And maybe I'm simplifying it too much, but it just doesn't seem hard in my simple mind.
Yeah, no, I agree. And to kind of, I guess, pull it back into pulse for a second. So we're seeing the opposite too. You know, we're getting these people that are inhuman claiming whatever ideology they believe in, you know, doing these horrible things. And I think to underline it, this Facebook killer that's just been on the news the last couple of days that killed that poor gentleman, Robert Goodwin, for no apparent reason. He didn't claim any you know, affiliation, so it's just a murder. But you can't claim an affiliation, it becomes something else. And again, I think that is a crazy concept. It's a murderer who went in and killed a bunch of other fellow human beings. That's where it ends. And you can either be a human and help your community, or you can be someone like that and hurt your community.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, you alluded earlier to, you know, the mental aspect for us, but there, you know, there's a big, especially when you look at the patients and victims of violent crimes and the violent crime people that commit those things. Obviously there's a big psychological component that we don't quite understand and that they are in desperate need of understanding and help with. And unfortunately that's a big void in our country right now, I think.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Well, I have taken an hour of your time and I really, really appreciate it. We had some technical difficulties earlier, so it's probably been closer to almost an hour and a half. So I thank you so much for that. I've got a couple of short questions and then we'll let you get on your way. So firstly, I always ask my guests this. Do you have any books and or movies or documentaries that you recommend to people that you rave about?
Specifically about what?
Anything at all.
I don't know. These are more of a personal, but there's a writer. He's kind of Christian based, but his name's John Eldridge. He speaks about. It's more to men, but it's, you know, what men are looking for and what they need in life and what they're supposed to do with their lives. And that one has really, he's been a great person to read different things about in my personal life and how I want to live my life.
Okay.
So he's a great one. You know, as far as, I think there's some other, you know, I've read a lot about the Boston bombings. I can't give you exact names right now, but different. There's a military surgeon who wrote a lot about those their events and their situation up there, and you know, there are a lot of things that happen by just by happenstance, right? And I can give you examples from our situation too. But for the Boston bombing, they, you know, they had additional EMS personnel at the finish line. You may or may not know that. And the reason is the previous year they had an increase in their heat stroke in, rates. And so they had extra personnel at the finish line.
Right.
They, and they, Patriots Day is probably the worst day those gentlemen, well, those guys could have picked, because, you know, the traffic is less because the whole city pretty much shuts down. And so, you know, that's why they had the good outcomes that they did for the injured ones that made it to the hospital. Because they had ease of access, they had more EMS personnel, and they could get to them, you know, to get them to the hospitals quicker. In our situation, you know, we had three or four ER residents that were on, that were working that night. Well, they were 2 weeks from graduating, so they were basically attending physicians. So that increased our complement of physicians significantly.
Right.
You know, it happened in June and not July. And if you work in academic centers, you recognize that July is when the transition occurs and you get the new interns. Whereas we had interns that had at least 11 months of experience underneath them. So they weren't, you know, shocked by what they were seeing. I mean, they were obviously to some extent with that, but they still knew how to facilitate and triage and help out significantly, you know. So the little things like that that just happened, that were, that if you look at all these different mass casualties, were present in these other situations too. So I think it goes to show that there's, while, you know, it'd be nice if these tragedies never happened, that there's at least some hand above that's kind of watching over those. That being said, you know, I can't give you a specific name on that, but any of those articles you read, I wish I could remember his name, but he's a military surgeon that worked in the Boston bombings, has very good evaluations of that. But those are kind of the big ones I've read about.
Did you see the Patriots Day movie they made?
I have.
Okay.
I have. I thought it was well done. I mean, it's a movie made for, you know, entertainment. It's got Mark Wahlberg. So it's definitely entertaining. Is it something, you know, I don't know. I tried to see if there anything I could learn and draw from it other than, you know, obviously the experience that they had and how, you know, I didn't recognize as an outsider how they shut that city down completely to find those individuals. That was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
The extremes they took and the decisions they had to make. So I really was impressed with that aspect of it.
Yeah, I know there was some medical glitches though. Like there's a lady there with a tube down her throat, and the guy said, "Yeah, she just told me whatever it was." And I'm like, "How did she tell you that? She's got a tube in her throat."
Yeah. Oh yeah, you can't know that. That's always hard. Something like that happens in a movie or video, or you're just like, "Well, I can't believe anything that happened now."
Yeah,
just part of being working in medicine, and we want everything realistic. So that makes it.
So what about any documentaries?
Yes. Little Town. I don't know if you've seen that yet. It's a documentary on the Sandy Hook shooting.
Oh, I haven't. No.
It was on PBS. Actually, I got to see one of the first screenings of it at the Eastern Association meeting for surgery of trauma. And very well done. In fact, the director visited here. And I think she has something in the works to do something about Orlando's experience. But that's a very good documentary going into the lives of the victims' families, even. I mean, it's, you'll need Kleenex. I mean, it's a very emotional documentary. But that was something that was very moving. And obviously, having seen it after our experience, it had even more meaning, I think. But that's something to look for. And something I think people would appreciate, especially after our experience. But it's called Little Town.
Okay.
And it's, again, you won't see it in theaters or anything like that, but it was on it. They were showing it on PBS. I'm sure if you Google it, though, it may even be on YouTube at some point in the future.
Okay, I'll have to look at that. My little boy was exactly the kindergarten age when that happened. So that was just absolutely gut-wrenching.
Sure. Well, yeah, this will be a very difficult one for you to see. Having kids, it makes it even more difficult. Yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, bringing it back up again, when you do need to decompress, you're done with your day, you know, you've been saving lives. What do you do as an outlet?
Well, yeah, I get to spend time with my boys. They're fantastic. They're 12. I have twin boys. They're a great outlet. They're just, you know, enjoying life, and it's fun to see them grow up. That's amazing to me how that they're 12 already. But beyond that, you know, reading and running, and be honest with you, you know, and swimming too. Swimming's been a good one, very good one. But spending time with my friends and family, and then I've done a lot of traveling just to do talks and meeting other people. And while that may not seem somewhat of an outlet because I'm still talking about the same things, I always take something away. You know, I go and teach the lesson of preparedness and you know, stop the bleed and all those things. Our whole facility and organization has taken that on as kind of our responsibility now, is not just to tell the story, but to tell people how to be prepared and how to do these things. But I always take something away. I always learn something, and it's fun to meet new people. I'm very blessed. People are so kind and giving, and want to hear our story. You know, give us more credit than I think we deserve. I mean, we're just doing our job just like you do, just like every other individual does. It just happened that we had a lot of work to do that day, but, you know, we didn't choose any of this by any stretch. So, but it's always fun to meet people and learn and take some of these lessons and, you know, bring it back here and make our community better. But really enjoying just that aspect of it too. Just the, as you mentioned, the tribal, because trauma is a tribe in itself. You know, the whole, you know, our trauma community as a whole is very small. I mean, I've met people even before this, but even more so now, from all the way from Seattle down to, you know, to here, to Boston, to Southern California, that, you know, I can call at any moment and just talk to them. And that's been, you know, it just makes our country seem so much smaller than it is. But that's been really enjoyable, getting to meet individuals on the National Committee on Trauma, the chairman of the Committee on Trauma, getting to meet him and call him and talk to him about different aspects of things has been just amazing, and he's been a great help for a lot of things. But doing all those things, but you know, when it comes down to it, you know, as far as just truly decompressing, I think running and swimming and exercise are still my main outlets.
Right. Yeah, that's a common denominator. I've said this multiple times on the show, but it's exercise and family are huge ones, and then hobbies, which obviously your passion for learning and growing in the trauma field is you know, I guess technically a hobby as well as a job. So all right. And then, so the last thing I'd say, where can people find you? But I'll expand that to where can people contact you and find your work, but also, if you want to, talk about where they can access information for programs like Stop the Bleed as well.
Sure. So let's do Stop the Bleed first, 'cause that's way more important than me. Stop the Bleed is, it's easy. It's stopthebleed.org. Very easy.
Okay.
Website. They have everything on there, material-wise, things that you need, great information. We at Orlando Health, if they're in the Central Florida area, they can go to our website and look for information as well. And we'll actually soon have, if it's not up already, have some sign-on capabilities for classes that we'll be offering. So, and they're free. So that's something to take advantage of. And then as far as for me, you can obviously find me on the hospital website. My email for the hospital is joseph.ibrahim@orlandohealth.com. And I'm glad to take, you know, any opportunities. I love to get involved with our community. I speak at high schools, talk to RMS agencies. I just love to be involved with these guys and get them involved with us more so, because again, Level One Center is part of the community. That's the main thing we want to get out there.
Brilliant. Yeah, I'd love to try and maybe in the future get you down to my department, Reedy Creek, because even though it doesn't make the news normally, because, you know, what happens at Disney stays in Disney. But
yes,
we do have, you know, an incredible amount of incidences that happen that, you know, may not be the same violent streets of some of the other areas of Orlando, but we have areas that we'd certainly need to stay trained on too. So
no, I would absolutely love that. No, I know you guys do a great job and a lot of training and things like that that occur behind the scenes. So yeah, I'd absolutely love to be involved with that anyway and help any way I can. I need Sabrina actually corrected me here, and she's right. The documentary is Newtown, not Littletown.
Newtown. Okay, I will change that. I'll put a link on that in the website as well.
Okay.
Brilliant. All right. So while we just pause for a second, then I'm going to I'll do the fake sign off, say goodbye to you, and then we can switch back to video, and I'll just talk to you about getting all this the links to you so that you can listen to it and share it as well. So. All right. So, well, thank you so much for your time, Joe. I really, really appreciate it. It's something that I personally wanted to do for a long time, way before this podcast, but actually just sit down with a surgeon like yourself and find out how I can become a better medic and raise the possibility of saving someone's life by doing the right things before we walk through your door. So I really, really appreciate you talking about that, and obviously, reliving that day, which I'm sure is not exactly the most comfortable thing to do.
No, it's my pleasure. It's again, we were given this opportunity, and it's our responsibility to share that with you guys. And again, my hat's off to all the first responders. Again, amazing job. We're blessed to have the comforts of all the things we have in the facility, and you guys do it at extremes that we can only imagine. So thank you for that, and thank you for this opportunity.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. You have a good day.